lover's got humor. She's the giggle at a funeral. Knows everybody's disapproval. I should've worshipped her sooner. If the heavens ever did speak, she's the last true mouthpiece. Every Sunday's getting more bleak. A fresh poison each week. We were born sick, you heard them say it. My church offers no absolutes. She tells me worship in the bedroom. The only heaven I'll be sent to is when I'm alone with you. I was born sick, but I love it. Command me to be well. Amen. 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 Take me to church. I'll worship like a dog at the shrine of your life. I'll tell you my sins and you can sharpen your knife. Offer me that deathless death, the good God. Let me give you my life. Take me to church. I'll worship like a dog at the shrine of your life. I'll tell you my sins and you can sharpen your knife. Offer me that deathless death, the good God. Let me give you my life. If I'm a pagan of the good time, my love is the sunlight. Keep the goddess on my side. She demands a sacrifice. Drain the whole sea, get some.
This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, and my guest this month is Carolyn Marks Blackwood, a photographer, producer, and something of an activist. Welcome, Carolyn.
Thank you.
I'm happy to be here on the river with you.
Not a bad place to be.
Not a bad place to be. Now, this has been a major subject of yours as a photographer. And right now you're concerned about this proposal to increase the number of moorings in the river.
Yes.
So how is that going?
Well, I got involved personally with the barge anchorages. I live on the river, and there would be barges, 1, 2, 3 barges would be sitting out in front of the house, right between Kingston and Esopus and Rhinecliff. And they each have stadium lighting. And they each have generators, which are going 24 hours a day. And if the wind is right, you kind of choke on the particulate that they're spewing out. I went back and forth with the Coast Guard about this to talk about these barges. And there were lots of other people around that were worried about them too, because they were having the same problems I was having. And it turned out, after back and forth, like for 6 months, that the Coast Guard said, well, we just found out they're parking illegally. Their legal anchorage is 7 miles to the south in Hyde Park. And so we're going to let them know that if they park there, it has to be for an emergency. And if it's not an emergency, then they're going to be fined. So that was the first thing that happened. And in 2012, the price of oil was pretty good. So there was a lot of traffic. Then the price of oil went down. So traffic has gotten much less. However, what has happened is, by the way, let me back up a moment and to say that this is about Bakken crude from North Dakota coming through the port of Albany and being transported to New Jersey, where it's refined. Bakken crude is an extremely dangerous and volatile mixture.
A low flash point.
Yes, it ignites at 74 degrees and has been the cause of some towns disappearing as trains exploded as they went through. And if it happened to leak into the river, it would be a major catastrophe and the river would be ruined for many, many decades for everybody. A lot of people get their drinking water from the river. Poughkeepsie does, Rhinebeck does, Esopus does, and I'm sure others, which I don't know about, not to mention recreation and, beauty.
And the wildlife.
And the wildlife, which is slowly coming back. So what happened was is the price of crude is still low, but now the ban which forbade the export of this oil has been lifted. So now we can export our own petroleum products. And this is what the companies, there's two companies involved that would like to have these 43 anchorages in 10 places.
Between
Yonkers and Kingston here. 43 is quite a lot of anchorages. And there are so many reasons why this shouldn't happen.
So far they've been permitted something like less than 10, right?
I don't know how many legal anchorages there are. I do know that in New York City you see them, and in Yonkers you see them, and sometimes in Hyde Park you see them parked. But I've been told by someone who's on the river all the time that he has never seen more than 6 barges sitting there. They're saying it's for safety reasons, and in actuality, any barge or any vessel that is in trouble or has safety problems can stop anywhere on the river without anchorages. So there goes that theory. Our theory is that they want to use these anchorages as storage up and down the river, either storage or places to get ready to go up to the port of Albany to pick up the crude, because it's a 24-hour port and they want just it to be humming along, picking up crude. And I was told by one of the crew members that if they're 10 minutes late, the boss gets really angry. So this is about two corporations versus everyone else on the river. The other arguments that they use are that, hey, you use heating oil, you use gas in your car. Well, this isn't going to be about local distribution the way it used to be. On the river, I used to see oil tankers going up and down the river, you know, all the time, but not at the frequency, not in the numbers that have been in the last few years since the Bakken crude opened up.
And not with these lights, probably.
No. No, I mean, the lights were, when they're anchored, they need these lights for safety.
Courage, is that something they actually build?
No, they actually anchor.
They tear
up the bottom of the river where shad are starting to come back and other species are starting to come back. The thing that did happen that I am suspicious about is when Andrew Cuomo, our governor, said that no fracking, we were all very happy and it was great. However, what Andrew Cuomo didn't say at the same time when he said no fracking was that he was going to open up the Port of Albany, expand it, and make it so that, well, basically we didn't need to frack because all this material from North Dakota is coming in and they want to build a pipeline on the other side of the river that's going to go down the thruway. There's pipelines galore and trains going through Kingston and through Albany that are called bomb trains. And they're called that because they've been known to explode with this stuff in it. And if there were a catastrophe in the river, let's put it this way. When there was the BP spill, enormous assets were sent there to try to clean up. And they basically got 5% of the oil. And it turned into a disaster area. And that's what would happen to the river. It would become a disaster area. Whole municipalities wouldn't be able to get their drinking water, and everything would be set backwards. It's really two corporations versus everyone else.
Two oil companies, I guess.
I'm a little hazy. I think they might be transportation of oil companies. And when the Port of Albany, by the way, was opened up the way it has been in the last 3 years, 4 years, it was done very quietly, without any announcement, without any environmental study about what the ramifications would be up and down the river. Well, we're starting to feel the ramifications.
So where do things stand now? Are there hearings?
The Coast Guard asked the request for a comment period. Actually, the deadline was tomorrow, September 7th, for comments, but they just expanded it, and now they're taking comments until December. I think it's December 5th. So that's good news.
Well, it's good news because it was a long time before anybody even knew what was going on.
Right, exactly. On Facebook, there's a group that's called Living on the Hudson River, and that has all the latest news. There's also a website that is very good that's called HudsonRiverAnchorages.org. And also, one of the best sites is Riverkeeper, who are very involved, as is Scenic Hudson. But Riverkeeper has wonderful, wonderful information in a very concise form that you can be informed in 10 minutes about everything that's happening. And John Lipscomb, who is the Riverkeeper, who lives on the river 7 months of the year, is fantastic and very much behind this. And I'm I would support John with whatever he wants to do. He's great. He's the real activist. He's putting his life his life is dedicated to the Hudson. I've gone out with him for 3 days at a time, and I've never learned so much. It's a thrill to go out with him.
How long have you lived on the river?
Since 2006. I was brought up on the water as a child in Long Island. And so when I moved to New York City, I was lucky enough to sort of land near Riverside Drive and always had the river close by. And almost every apartment except for my first apartment has really looked over the river. So when Greg and I came here and we got a farm, which is a working farm, Greg's a farmer, and we have currants, And he has a company, a current company. If anyone's interested, it's currents.com. And he has tons of current products. When we came here, I felt extremely landlocked. So I decided that I would look for either land or a little house or something on the river. And I looked for 5 years. One day, someone told me about this house, that there was a divorcing couple, and they were, I should look at this house in Rhinecliff. And it wasn't exactly what I had in mind, because it was in the middle of town. And I just thought, I don't know if I want to live so close to people. But when we got on the land and looked out facing west, it was mesmerizing. And you forgot what was in back of you, which is the town. And you look west where the sun sets, and you look west where the storms come. And it really, you know, I had been a photographer before this, but I had never been so inspired. And it really started my photography career coming here 10 years ago.
Very first photographs were ice.
Yeah. One day when I first moved here, the first winter in 2006, I was walking outside taking pictures of the mist on the river. And I heard this cracking sound, and I couldn't figure it out. So I went down to the dock, which we have a little park and a little dock in Rhinecliff. And there was this ice, this sheets of ice that were like breaking up like glass. And I just ran back and got my camera and started taking pictures of this ice reflecting in the morning light. And they were geometry. They were shapes, and the sound was unbelievable. It was fantastic. And around 16 shots in, my battery ran out, which is a mistake I haven't made since then. And I just thought, you know, I had to go to the city that day. I'm going to come back tomorrow morning and I'll take more pictures. Well, the next morning, everything had melted. I had to wait a whole year. And all I was thinking about was like, how could I have been so stupid to think that it was going to be the same tomorrow morning? You know, I'll just come back and take some more pictures. Well, I waited a whole year. The next year, of course, was not the same. And it's never the same. As a matter of fact, every hour on the river is different. It looks completely different. The same place. So I've sort of made a study of this place and gotten to know it pretty well.
Did you always love weather?
Oh, I'm a weather maniac. When I was a little girl, I think that it stems from being 5 years old and being scared of a big thunderstorm. And my dad, who was also a weather person, brought me up to the attic and we looked at the lightning and then we counted between the thunder and the lightning. And he just taught me, you know, not to be scared, but to be fascinated by it. Taught me about the Milky Way and shooting stars, and he loved all that stuff. And so he taught me to love it. And I'm, you know, I love the weather. I'm sort of a weather maniac and can watch it very well from this spot.
You have a great vantage point to watch the storms roll in and so on.
Snowstorms, thunderstorms come over from the west. Snowstorms usually come over from the northwest. No, it's fantastic. Cloud formations. It's a big sky here. It's not the usual northeast kind of sky, which is usually obstructed by trees. Here I have 100-mile sky, so it's great. And where else do you get to look at the lighthouse and the Catskills? And it's fantastic. I feel extremely lucky to be here. I love sharing it.
And you take a lot of photographs from here.
I shoot pretty much every day. I mean, there's something of interest most days. It's very rare that I look out the window and think, boy, how boring. There's usually something to look at some time, either early in the morning or when the sun's setting or when a storm's coming. The only thing that might be a little boring are these beautiful blue days without any clouds, one after the other, sort of the LA weather. You know, that depresses me. It's so weird. I think I have, you know, what is that? Seasonal affect disorder. I think I get that in the summer. And in the winter, I am happy and energized. And as soon as fall starts to come around, I start feeling good. Summer is my least favorite. It's my downtime, you know, except for storms. I do like storms.
Now, what did you study at school?
Oh, at school, I actually was going to get my PhD in sociology. And what happened was there was a jazz department. I was also a professional singer. I sound sort of like a sketchy character with all these things I've done, but I was a singer, and there was a great jazz department. It was at Rutgers University, Livingston College. And some of the best jazz people were teaching there. And so I was taking graduate courses in sociology and like music courses, and ended up in a practice room one day with a guy knocked on the door, and he said, "Wow, you sound good. Can I listen?" So I said, "Sure." And he turned out to be this very famous bass player named Bob Cranshaw, who... he hired people in the city to do everything from the Saturday Night Live to Sesame Street. Oh, so he said to me, well, at the end of my listening to me, he said, "Well, you know, I'm playing at Hopper's with the Joe Newman Quartet. Would you like to come sing with us?" And I went, "Really?" And he went, "Really?" So I went to New York City and I went to Hopper's, and it was like, I was sort of flabbergasted by the people that were playing and didn't have the courage to get up and sing, but sat there three times and watched them, and they would beckon to me to come and sing, and I just didn't have the courage. And finally, like the fourth time, I got up and I sang. It was sort of a disaster because I sang "Someone to Watch Over Me," and I sang the Ella Fitzgerald version, which has a bridge in it in the middle, which she sang double time. And so I sang it double time. And so I was left with 16 bars. I was done, and they were still doing 16 bars more. And I just thought, oh, well, that's the end of that career, except they asked me to sing with them. So I actually left school. I left a husband. I moved to New York and I started a singing career. Yeah, it was just crazy when I think about it. That was in my 20s.
And you also wrote songs.
Yeah, I used to write songs too. And I've always been taking photographs. Always, always, always. I just never showed them to anyone.
And as I remember, you had a show in Rhinebeck that a very well-known art critic happened to see?
Yeah. After I moved in the house, I took some beautiful photographs of fog over the lighthouse over there. And they were having a fundraiser for our little Morton Library. And I offered them, and they took them, these two pictures, which sold really, really well for $800. They were like 8x10s or something. And I put them in a frame, and I didn't know what I was doing. I just did it on my, you know, printer. And there were little pictures, and they sold for $800. So the Morton Library said, would you like to show in the spring? We're having a show of 15 artists. I was thrilled. And I just got my pictures blown up, and I framed them, and I showed them, and I sold most of them. And during that show, an art critic came in named Barbara Rose, who's a pretty famous art critic, and she's written a lot of books. And she said, "I'm doing a show in Chelsea with two photographers and two painters. Would you like to be in the show?" And I said, "Yeah, thank you." But it was a very strange experience for me because it was sort of like playing softball with your friends in the park, and then the Yankees come and they say, "Do you want to play for the Yankees?" So I really had to learn a lot of stuff really quick. It was kind of a strange time for me. I felt like I didn't deserve it.
Now, how long ago was that?
That was 2007. It's been a very, very quick learning curve.
Now, how did you get involved with the movies?
Oh, I've been involved in the movies since around the 1980s. I was married to a filmmaker named Christian Blackwood, who was a very well-known documentary filmmaker. He must have made around 95, 100 films, mostly for German TV. And so he was interested in doing a feature film, and he saw that I was writing scripts, and he asked me if I would write this script. And so, unfortunately, before he got a chance to make the film, he died in 1992, but I continued on writing. I wrote a script which a producer named Gabrielle Tana was interested in, and then we became partners over the years. That was a long time ago. That was 1992 that we first met, and we became official partners in 1997.
And now your current project.
Our current project, I must say, this is Gabby's, my partner's, love project. It's all her sweat, blood, sweat, and tears. It's called Dancer. It's the story of Sergei Polunin. Steve Cantor was director. But Gabby has been working on this for years. And, of course, I supported it and helped in any way that I could. But it's really her baby. And she should be very proud, and Steve should be very proud, because it's turned into a beautiful movie.
And you seem to have sort of brought Sergei Polunin into the local community.
Yeah, well, Sergei actually is going to be showing up for a screening at Upstate Films, which is going to be a fundraiser for Upstate, on the 18th of September at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And he's going to show up for it. So is Gabby. And I love having, you know, we've done movies like Philomena and The Invisible Woman and The Duchess, and we've had my favorite screenings. I mean, we go all over the world for all the openings and everything like that, but my most favorite screenings are at Upstate Films, where we always have sort of friends and family or a fundraiser, or, you know, the hometown screening of something is my most favorite, and that's going to be on the 18th.
And he was also at Barb recently, I think.
Yeah, I'm very involved with the Fisher Center for the Performing Arts, and I was able to bring him to perform Take Me to Church. I mean, do you know about that?
Oh, I do. I've watched it a dozen times.
Yeah, well, Take Me to Church, Sergei danced this piece that's part of our film that David LaChapelle actually directed, and it went viral like around a year and a half ago. And there's like 16 million hits on it. We're hoping that it sort of translates for this documentary. So he came here and actually danced Take Me to Church, which was a total thrill. I mean, it was mesmerizing as a fundraiser for the Fisher Center at Bard. It was sort of chilling. Everyone had their mouths open. It was beautiful. So that it was wonderful that he came and did that. And Jade came too, who's the choreographer, his best friend. So those two lovely young men came, and it's through my partner that I met them, but I've known them for a while now. And they were really generous to come here, and they were very impressed. I mean, Sergei would love to dance here. So we're trying to figure something out. He's like right up there in the pantheon of the greats, really. When you see, you can just... And the film really, really illustrates that. You see a lot of dancing in the film and his struggle. It's a very personal story. It's much more than just a dance film. It's the story. It's a story of somebody who came from the Ukraine and whose family was divided up they went all over the world to support his dancing because he was such a good dancer. And to support him, they sort of scattered to the winds. And I'm not going to say anything more because I don't want to give it away, but it's quite a touching story.
There's a very nice trailer on YouTube, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
It's beautifully done.
It kind of, you can kind of see the story from that, but I'm not going to give anything away.
Well, I would recommend checking it out. I'd seen that, you know, I really had no idea who he was, but I love the dance, and I've been looking at everything.
He's very, very big in Europe. Very, I mean, it's really strange because was it 2012 or 2000? Yeah, I think it was 2012. I actually went to see him at the Royal Ballet. And I saw him and my partner was there meeting him, I think, then. But I saw him sort of cold and you know, it was a thrill. He was sort of the next Nureyev or the next Misha, you know. So, and so the way it's turned out is he's dancing, he's forming his own company, and he's invited to dance for special occasions, like for festivals or for, you know, a certain thing is choreographed and he'll be there for that one dance, you know, and it might take, you know, be over 2 weeks that he dances it, but he's picking and choosing what he wants to do.
And his company will be in Russia?
His company, you know, I think I'm a little sketchy on that. I think it might be in England, but I'm sure it'll have Russian affiliation because he is in Russia a lot.
Well, I hope lots of people see it.
I hope so, too. Everyone who, like, take me to church, go see it. And also, because it's not going to be widely distributed, it's going to be in Los Angeles, it's going to be in New York, it's going to be in big cities, but it's going to be on demand because it's IFC and it's going to be Sundance Selects. So it'll be Sundance on demand starting, I think, September 16th. So people will be able to see it.
What are you doing currently in the way of photography? Or do you have a particular series you're working on right now?
Yes, I'm working on a new series called The Story. Well, it's not really new. I've been working on it for over 5 years. But I've been very interested in abstraction in nature. When I see things, I'm very informed by abstract expressionism. And so when I see things, somehow everything gets translated into abstraction. I mean, I love taking pictures of the river and you see the river and I put my Facebook pictures of the river up. But for my galleries, I'm very interested and they're very interested in abstraction. And so I have water abstractions. I have sky abstractions. I mean, I just see abstraction wherever I go. So this new series, which I've been working on for 5 years, and I haven't let the cat out of the bag, is called the Story Series. And it's not abstraction. It's very strange. It's a lot of night scenes. And underneath, I put the beginning of a story, which is disturbing and also unfinished so that everyone has to finish it themselves. So it's very conceptual in a way, but I have to say that I love them and they're very beautiful. I mean, look, a lot of them take place at night, like with snow all over and branches. They're very narrative. They're very cinematic. It's almost like a combination between my film work and my photography work. Somehow in this series, they're coming together. And they're very cinematic. I mean, they sort of take you someplace, and you are there. And I'm also mining my 12-year-old runaway self in some of them. In other ones, I'm mining a part of me that is imagining, because I'm a screenwriter, I have a good cinematic imagination, so a lot of it sort of feels like it's about abuse. A lot of it feels like, you know, sort of what you see isn't what you get. You know, one of them even was a picture of a house with a white picket fence and snow, and it looks ideal. And it's sort of like, it looks like a nice house, but things aren't always what they seem. You know, that kind of a thing. And a lot of them are like that. That, and a lot of them are about escaping. I mean, they're very identifiable, and I'm doing them large, like 60 by 64. So you almost feel like you can walk into the scene. And I'm very excited about them. And I have some people in New York that are pretty excited about them too. And I'm working on some new ones right now. And my gallerist in LA says he's pretty excited about them also. So hopefully I'll be able to show them this next year.
Do you still work with Chad Kleitsch as a printer?
Oh, Chad is great. He's my printer. He's much more than my printer. I mean, like, Chad is sort of my problem solver. And, I mean, we work very, very closely together. If I have a picture, we're in there together working on it. But we sort of talk shorthand now. We've been working since 2007 together. And he's my main man. And he's a very good photographer in his own right.
Yes, he is. And he's...
He's a delightful human being.
A delightful human being and a complete perfectionist.
Yes. And so he and I get along really, really well. He also encourages me to do things that I normally wouldn't do. I had this huge show that was in the Fisher Center in the Frank Gehry building. I did one photograph, an abstraction, a water abstraction, that was like 26 feet by 24 feet. It was like a room, and it was in this fantastic architectural space, and it was done in 6 pieces. And I really almost didn't have the courage to do it, but Chad sort of kicked me in the butt and made me do what I had been dreaming about doing. I mean, I did say to him, like, if it looks horrible, we can always take it down. But it looked fantastic. He sometimes has more faith in me than I have in myself. So, you know, Chad is wonderful. But it was a thrill to be in this huge space and to be able to do what I wanted to do. It was sort of a dream. You never get to have a 26-foot picture. Where? How? You know, it was great. It was really a dream come true. And it was really nice of the Fisher Center to ask me. I was very flattered. And
you were keeping a studio in the city for a while.
I have it.
You do?
I still have it. It just, you know, because my gallery in the city closed, I just felt like I wanted to have some kind of a presence there that people can come. And I'm going to be seriously looking for a New York City gallery. I have a couple of galleries snooping around. And so I'm going to be inviting people to come and see the work there. It's nice because it's very hard for them to come here and see work. Yeah, I have a beautiful gallery in the Chelsea Arts Building. I'm so thrilled to have it. It's a beautiful space, and it's a great building of artists. I mean, it's just filled with art spaces and galleries, and it's
nice to be around that energy. Also.
It really is. And I go in once a week and go to the studio and have studio visits and stuff like that. I'm going to start again in a few weeks. So I'm thrilled. I mean, that is really lucky. I was on a waiting list for quite a long time.
Do you have any movie projects?
We have a bunch of movie projects. I'm writing a script right now that's based on a book. And we have a project that is, the name of the book is The 16 Pleasures. And it takes place in Florence during the floods of the 60s. And it's sort of a love story. But anyway, and then we have something coming up that's about the defection of Nureyev. And we have a few other movies. I sort of look at movies like airplanes coming into the airport. You know, they're circling around at different stages. until something lands, I'm really scared to talk about them because I used to talk about, you know, like with the Duchess, I was talking about it for 5 years before it landed and people were looking at me kind of like, yeah, the Duchess, you know. So I don't really like talking about things until they're happening, and then everyone knows they're happening.
So thank you very much, Carolyn.
You're very welcome. This was fun. Thank you for asking me.
A pleasure.
There's a saying old says that love is blind. Still we're often told, seek and ye shall find. So I'm going to seek a certain lad I've had in mind. Looking everywhere, haven't found him yet. He's a big affair I cannot forget. Only man I ever think of with regret. I'd like to add his initial to my monogram. Tell me, where is the shepherd for this lost lamb? There's a somebody I'm longing to see. I hope that he turns out to be someone who'll watch over me. I'm a little lamb who's lost in the wood. I know I could always be good to one who'll watch over me. Although he may not be the man some girls think of as handsome, to my heart he carries the key. Won't you tell him, please, to put on some speed, follow my lead. Oh, how I someone to watch over me.
That, of course, was Ella Fitzgerald. Now to finish the hour, part of the score for one of the great Balanchine ballets, Mozartiana, Tchaikovsky Suite No. 4, Michael Tilson Thomas conducting the Philharmonia Orchestra. Thank you.
Thank you.